From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos is accusing the National Enquirer of attempted extortion. Bezos claims the gossip tabloid threatened to post nude photos of him. The Enquirer recently disclosed Bezos' extramarital affair, and he'd hired investigators to look into how the Enquirer got evidence. We'll debate the legal issues at play coming up next on Air Talk.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering three psychology master's degrees this April. Priority deadline to apply for summer term scholarship is February 15th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us wherever you are in Southern California. Coming up in our second hour of Film Week with our critics, the new Lego movie is out. The second part, they're calling it. We'll hear if it's as funny and creative as the first one. Also, What Men Want, Taraji P. Henson stars in the film directed by Adam Shankman. And we'll talk about the Oscar-nominated shorts, the live-action films, as well as the animated and the documentaries that are the shorts. All of them are being screened locally. But first, we begin with Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Washington Post, the CEO of Amazon, who disclosed late yesterday that the National Enquirer had threatened to post nude photos of him if he didn't call off an investigation that he had started with private investigators to determine how the Enquirer ended up with photographic evidence of the extramarital affair that he was carrying out. Once the Enquirer had that news, Bezos then came out with the word that he and his longtime wife were breaking up. With us to talk about the legal issues that are raised is Michael Overing, principal in the law offices of Michael Overing in Pasadena, also adjunct professor media law at SC Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. Michael, good to have you with us. Appreciate it so much.
Sure. Good to be here.
So let's start, first of all, with the legal issue of extortion. If in fact, the Enquirer was saying that if you call off the investigation, we won't post the nude photos of you. But if you continue with the investigation, we will post the photos. Is that extortion?
Well, I think that the question really has to be looked at from what it is that the Enquirer was asking. And if we believe the documentation that Jeff Bezos put in the paper, then indeed they're saying, hey, we want you to come forward and we want you to say some things that, we didn't have a basis for what the Washington Post was doing, and causing him to go forward and say things that he wouldn't ordinarily say is a little bit more than the kinds of free speech types of things where if somebody says, I've got these photographs and I'm going to publish them, well, that's perfectly legal. But saying, I won't publish them if you say something that's untrue, that seems to cross the line.
All right. And are there special First Amendment protections that a publication like the Enquirer has that might apply that wouldn't apply in other circumstances where you had an alleged communication like this?
Well, you normally have the right to publish anything that you have obtained lawfully. So if they obtain these photographs lawfully, there's absolutely nothing that prevents them from publishing them. The question is, if they're proposing a commercial transaction, I'll give you this if you give me that. As long as those two things are related, it's probably fine. But where this crosses the line, or at least goes into a murky area, is when they take it and they say, well, we're going to publish these photographs unless you drop this other investigation and say that we were not at fault. That seems to take it just a little bit further than a regular First Amendment analysis would be.
Well, let me bring in media ethicist Kelly McBride, senior VP at the Poynter Institute and head of the Craig Newmark Center for Ethics and Leadership at Poynter. Kelly, good to have you with us again.
Thank you for having me.
So I know we're dealing with the National Enquirer, so this is different than a traditional journalistic ethics conversation. But how has has the Inquirer typically, you know, practiced these sorts of things? Is it sort of consistent practice? If they get photographic evidence of an affair like this, they're going to publish it.
Well, it certainly fits into the overall genre of the types of things that they publish. They're a tabloid, right? So they publish things that are scandalous, and certainly scandalous photos of the CEO of one of the most expensive companies in the world fits into their beat, if you will. You can't separate out the politics from this, though, in their history, particularly with this president. And so it's really impossible to say if they were motivated simply by their own journalism or if they were motivated by something else.
And I guess I was a little skeptical. Bezos sort of making it sound like because the Washington Post goes after Trump, therefore, and that Trump has such strong disdain for Bezos, that was what motivated the Inquirer. But, you know, they've gone after plenty of other high-profile media people and wealthy individuals.
They've killed stories that have benefited Trump.
Yeah. But obviously that wouldn't happen in a case like this. So because there's no benefit to Trump in taking the photos of Bezos out. So I guess I wonder how much of this really is, if this is the kind of thing that they do, whether it's an on-air personality or a wealthy person, does Bezos really have much cover that this is politically motivated?
Well, if you look at what they were asking for, they were asking him to say that it was not politically motivated. That's what makes you think it was politically motivated.
All right. Let me go back to our legal analyst, Michael Overing. Michael, the federal prosecutors in New York, according to the Associated Press, are looking at whether what the National Enquirer did violated a cooperation agreement that they had. This related to the killing of stories where the Enquirer bought accounts of sexual activity, the alleged sexual activity between the president and a couple of women, and that was a violation of campaign finance laws. Do you think that something like this might apply to that and could be a violation of an agreement to cooperate?
Well, the question really is what the extent of that agreement was. Certainly when the Inquirer was asked to sign off on that and then provided information and documents to the feds, there was an indication that there was some kind of cooperative agreement. The question is whether or not they have violated that agreement. That would be a very different issue than the question of whether or not this is extortion or blackmail.
What's your sense of why the Inquirer would put this in writing? If this is confirmed, that this sort of quid pro quo was offered, why would they do that in writing and leave themselves vulnerable to this?
I would think that they weren't thinking that this was going to constitute extortion or blackmail. Remember that you can say, stop your unlawful activity or I'm going to call the police, is not an illegal thing to do. So I think that if you take a look at the words that they used, I think they were staying just on the right side, if you will, of what the First Amendment would protect. They're proposing a commercial transaction. The question is whether or not they stepped over it when they said, and by the way, you know, Mr. Bezos, the Washington Post is going to essentially print a retraction favorable to us. That's where I think this probably crossed over. But there's nothing wrong with proposing a contract. I can talk to you about whether or not you want to sell me turnips, and I can certainly have you respond to that. The question is, sell me turnips or I shoot your wife, seems to cross that line.
All right. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Jimmy in downtown Los Angeles says he takes issue with extortion being defined as you just did it, Michael. He says, Jimmy says, well, I'm a lawyer and extortion really is a threat of accusing someone of a crime if they won't pay a bribe or do what you want them to do. Do you see it as that narrowly focused?
Well, the issue on extortion is it's going to be dependent upon state law and whether or not this is being prosecuted under federal law or how you're looking at it. But usually extortion is when you want to obtain property or other consideration based upon a wrongful use of force or fear. So is it wrongful? I mean, we've got people at the very top end of this country in terms of their sophistication. If this is simply a proposal for a commercial transaction, that doesn't look like extortion. But if the proposal that is being made by AMI is for something that they're not otherwise entitled to, and they're forcing the victim, Bezos, to speak in ways that are untrue, then it crosses that line.
I wonder, too, about the method of getting photographic evidence of the affair. Bezos doesn't seem to think that he was hacked, that this came from someone close to either him or his girlfriend, Lauren Sanchez. And if these photos that document the relationship were taken from a personal phone of the individuals, is that a crime?
Not necessarily, because if I hand you my cell phone, and you go through it, I have given you permission. The question is, how far did the permission go? So if you ask to use my phone because you need to call AAA for a tow, that's different than if you search through my photos and decide to send them to yourself via my email.
So it is potentially prosecutable, depending on how those photos were obtained.
Correct. But the issue would be who took them, who stole them. And that in that case, Bezos would make the argument that this person who was close to Ms. Sanchez is the one who took them. The fact that AMI ended up with them may or may not be illegal.
We're talking with attorney Michael Overing. He teaches at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism in private practice in Pasadena. Kelly McBride, senior VP of the Poynter Institute, media ethicist. If you have questions for them about the dispute between Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos and the parent company of the National Enquirer, we're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Kelly McBride, you have a sense of whether this head-to-head between, you know, the media titans could potentially lead to a change of practice on the part of the Enquirer.
Oh, I don't think the Enquirer is going to change. This practice is fairly well established. You know, the Enquirer pays for stories. They have said in the past that they are not necessarily interested in the pursuit of absolute truth as much as they are, can they legally publish information that will sensationalize a story or titillate the audience. And so I think the only thing that would change about the Enquirer is if something happened to put them out of business. I don't think that they would change otherwise.
There was the famous case years ago, and I think it was the Enquirer, that was sued by Carol Burnett, wasn't it?
Yes, but I'm not going to be able to recall the facts.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was something that they had written a story, as I recall, that essentially she was drunk and out of control in public, and it was a totally fabricated event, and she sued them and won. That's one of the cases that I remember where a celebrity fought back about an untrue story and prevailed.
Yeah, but I think what she won was a forced correction. She might have even gotten a settlement. It didn't change their overall practices, though.
Yeah, no, good point. Very, very good point. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Michael Overing, does the Hulk Hogan case bear any similarities here?
Well, the important thing in the Hulk Hogan case with Gawker is the fact that the photographs and the video were obtained illegally, and that makes all the difference. So if AMI obtained these photographs and they got them legally, they can run them. And the issue is their right to run them is absolute under the First Amendment. The problem is they said, well, wait a minute, we won't run them if you do X. That's where the problem occurs.
All right. Also, the Inquirer, to my knowledge, because it's sold in supermarkets, like, I don't think they put nude photos in the Inquirer. So, you know, what in what way would the national would they put this out then potentially through a third party, Michael, or how would these photos end up seeing the light of day?
Well, the question is what they would do with them. They may run with them and they put them in their publication and black out the juicy parts, or they may submit them to another third party and let that third party run it that doesn't have the same constraints.
And Kelly, are you aware of the Inquirer ever doing something like that in the past involving nude photos?
They usually put a black bar over the naughty bits.
All right. Okay. Thank you both. Appreciate your talking through the legal issues that are raised by Jeff Bezos's claim he was extorted by the National Enquirer. Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute, head of the Craig Newmark Center for Ethics and Leadership at Poynter, and Michael Overing in private practice in Pasadena. And he teaches media law at SC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Coming up, we're going to take a look at two bills in the state legislature. Both came out of the same process, but have very different ways of attempting to deal with officer-involved shootings. We'll talk about them in 1 minute on Air Talk. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You might recall in the last legislative session, there was a bill that was designed to make it easier to criminally prosecute police officers who have shot suspects. And there was a panel set up with various stakeholders to try and come up with some sort of a bill that would have support from civil liberties groups, from law enforcement and others. Well, two different approaches, two different bills have come out of that process. One of them from San Diego Democratic Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, which has ACLU and other civil liberties groups support, would let prosecutors consider an officer's actions before the shooting as to whether there is criminal culpability in a shooting which injured or killed a member of the public. In other words, if the officer did something that was very poor practices, that was didn't show good judgment, that could be considered in a prosecution. Another bill that has yet to be formally introduced, but is expected to be introduced soon, would focus on $300 million being provided in state funding for mental health and homelessness programs. It would work on improving departmental rules and training for law enforcement officers, and would also require officers to attempt de-escalating a situation before resorting to the use of deadly force. With us to talk about the two bills, Peter Biebring, the Director of Police Practices for the ACLU of Southern California. Peter, good to have you with us again.
Good to be here, Larry.
Let's start with the bill that's been introduced that would allow, under the law, the actions of the officer that potentially put him or her into harm's way, requiring the use of lethal force. Specifically, how would that change the law?
Sure, Larry. And let me say, I think it's this bill is not just about prosecuting officers. It's about setting clear standards for when officers could use force, standards that could be enforced through disciplinary proceedings by disciplining or firing officers when they violate those standards, through civil actions or through criminal prosecutions. And that's a contrast from the other bill, which is backed by law enforcement groups, which really sets no minimum standards at all and just says departments should adopt policies that address use of force and address certain questions about use of force like de-escalation, but doesn't set any requirements. And actually, I want to correct something you said. That bill does not require that officers would use de-escalation. It requires that departments have a policy on whether or not officers are required to use de-escalation, but doesn't say anything about what that policy should be. So a department that that didn't have a de-escalation policy, didn't want to require de-escalation, wouldn't be forced to do so by the bill.
Okay. On the specific issue, though, of prosecution of officer-involved shootings, what are the kinds of prior acts by the officer that could be considered under this?
Sure. Well, the basic rule that that the bill that we are backing, Assembly Bill 392, would put in place is a rule that officers should use deadly force only when necessary. In other words, only when there were a reasonable officer in the same situation would think that there were no alternatives to the use of deadly force to prevent a threat of imminent death or bodily harm. And so in making the determination whether a use of force was necessary, a decision maker, whether that's the chief who's deciding whether to impose discipline or a jury in a civil trial or a criminal trial, could look at not just the moment that the officer decided to pull the trigger, but also the officer's actions leading up to that moment. So if the officer entered a situation and acted completely outside of policy and training in a way that was so outside of general standards for officers is to show a disregard for human life, something that would qualify as manslaughter, essentially, if anyone else did it, that officer could also be charged with criminal manslaughter.
Now, if... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I mean, look, in any other profession, if somebody violates the standards of the profession to a point that shows a disregard for human life, they can be prosecuted. So if somebody who runs a mining company or a bus company ignores safety regulations in such a way that it shows a disregard for human life and somebody dies as a result, that person can be prosecuted, not for murder, but for manslaughter, and they may get some time in jail. And all this bill would do is apply that standard to police as well. Under current law, the immunity for officers who kill is so broad under a law that was actually enacted in 1872 at the time when California was literally the Wild Wild West, that it makes it nearly impossible to hold officers accountable when they use force unnecessarily. And this bill would put in place standards that are already in use at departments across the country, including places like San Francisco and Seattle, and have worked to reduce force in those jurisdictions and would put those best practices into California.
Peter Biebring, ACLU of Southern California, with us. Also joining us, one of the directors of the Los Angeles Police Protective League, the union representing LAPD officers, Robert Harris. Robert, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So what are your concerns about this ACLU-backed bill, what it would mean for officers using deadly force?
Well, I think it's sad that Peter and the ACLU are demonstrating that they're a one-trick pony again. This is exactly the same conversation that we had last year. The bill is virtually the same. And what law enforcement did since last legislative session up until now is we did go to the table in good faith. And what we came up with was more than what the ACLU has given. What the ACLU has put forward is just a single bill. That does absolutely nothing to make interactions between our police and community safer. It's just a moment for them to grandstand. And what law enforcement has done is we have actually put together a plan to ensure that our community stays safer. And we've done that under the heading of Protect California, which is a coalition of law enforcement associations. And part of that plan, one component of that, is the legislative bill, SB 230. That we put forward, but there are also other components of it that seek to address our mental health crisis in our state. We want to address economic and education opportunities to grow the middle class. And when it comes to the legislative side, our bill is a first in the country attempt at standardizing use of force and de-escalation best practices. And it's disingenuous for Peter to get on the air and try and make it sound like there is some sort of training component in their bill. There isn't. It's a rehashing of last year, and that's put cops in jail and make it easier for the ACLU to come in and sue cities and sue jurisdictions. And that does nothing to keep our community safer.
What about, though, the contention, getting back to the substance of the bill, Peter Biebring arguing that it's virtually impossible to successfully prosecute a police officer now for killing a civilian, even if the officer engaged in blatantly unprofessional, high-risk, foolish conduct, it's still almost impossible, that this would put the onus on the officer for having, you know, used professional practices up to the shooting.
Yeah, it's just not true. And that's what the ACLU gets to do. They get to say things that aren't true. I mean, we've seen this in their support of Proposition 57 when they promised that early release would not apply to violent criminals. We see that that's not true. And in this case, that's not true either. Criminal prosecutions are possible for police officers. And the method that they are trying to do it in their bill would simply make it easier to prosecute officers. There's already a standard at the U.S. Supreme Court level. And these are life and death situations. There are situations that Peter has never been in or anybody from the ACLU. And proclaim that making it easier to prosecute them does not do anything to make our community safer, and it doesn't address the real concern. There's nothing in there about training officers up to a standard. Everybody, I think, agrees that officers should be held accountable for their actions. And I'll tell you personally, in Los Angeles, when an officer uses serious force, there's no less than 3 separate parallel investigations that go on at one time. So the notion that nothing can happen to these rogue officers is just disingenuous.
Peter Biebring, you want to respond?
Sure. Yes. I mean, I think, look, it's important to note, California has a problem with police use of deadly force. We have the highest number of police killings of civilians in the country. We had 172 in 2017. That's not just a function of the fact that California is the biggest state. California police kill members of the public at a rate approximately 37% higher than the national average and nearly 5 times higher per capita than police in New York State. California has a problem, and the simplest way to change how many people get killed by police is to change the rules on when police can shoot. Now, Mr. Harris has indicated that there's no problem with prosecutors charging officers who shoot unnecessarily. But the fact is that prosecutors almost never file charges. In the last 10 years in the whole state of California, in fact, more than 10 years, I believe that only 3 officers have been charged in a shooting, the shooting of Oscar Grant, actually in a killing, the shooting of Oscar Grant, the beating of Kelly Thomas, the fatal beating of Kelly Thomas, and a shooting in Sonoma County. The fact is that officers are not held accountable when they kill unnecessarily. That's because of the legal standard, and this bill will save lives. That is the goal. By changing the standard, of course the training will change. Of course departments will have to change their policies because they will have to set policies and training that conform to California law. And the bill that the law enforcement interests have introduced sets no minimum standards. It says officers, that departments have to have these policies, but doesn't say in any way what those policies have to be.
Robert Harris, L.A. Police Protective League, how do you explain the differential on the per capita rate of use of deadly force by California police officers?
Well, before I answer that, I just want to respond to one thing Peter said, because I think it's striking. I never hear the ACLU or Peter talk about the violent crime problem that we have in California, right? The ACLU, they like to throw out the disingenuous number of 172 people were killed in California. And what he fails to tell you is that only 13 of those encounters did the individual not have a gun. But that doesn't mean that there weren't violent circumstances surrounding that. So I'm going to say that again. 172 were shot in 2017 or killed by police. Only 13 of those didn't have a firearm. But there were violent circumstances surrounding it. And yes, criminal prosecutions of officers should be the highest or should be put through the highest standard and threshold. And when prosecutors don't do that, it's because the complexity of those situations is so great but it doesn't mean that there are not law enforcement officers that are prosecuted.
Okay.
And what I would love to hear the ACLU do is come up with some solutions or offer something to help cut down on the violent crime rates.
Okay, I need to break, but I want to get back to my question I asked. Why do you think California has such a higher per capita rate of officer use of lethal force than, say, New York or elsewhere?
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with some of the things that Protect California is seeking to do, and that is these are complex issues that drive violent crime. So let's start addressing the violent crime issue. When there is violent crime, it requires law enforcement to be in those high crime areas. And, of course, the propensity for use of force and sometimes lethal force is greater. So let's stop talking about the 172, and let's start talking about the communities that are suffering constantly with higher violent crime rates.
Gentlemen, I need to break. That's Robert Harris, L.A. Police Protective League. He's on the board of directors. That's the union representing LAPD officers. And ACLU of Southern California Director of Police Practices, Peter Biebring. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, LA Times columnist Steve Lopez joins us to talk about a column on those varmints that get into our house, that tear up our yard. How do you deal with them? We'll talk about the challenges of the wildlife of Southern California right after a live update from Tammy Trujillo. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in just a few minutes, it's Film Week. Our critics review The Lego Movie 2, the second part. The first one was such a surprising pleasure. It'd be interesting to see if they're able to recapture the fun of the first Lego film. Also, What Men Want, starring Taraji P. Henson, Adam Shankman, the director of that film. We'll also talk about the Oscar-nominated shorts. They're available for screening in selected theaters. That's the animation, the short docs, and the short dramatic films as well. So we'll talk about those. That's coming up on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. But first, LA Times columnist Steve Lopez joins us. He, of course, spends considerable time reporting on matters of great public urgency, corruption, people whose lives have taken a terrible turn and are trying to deal with challenges. But it's a recent column that I want to talk with him about that I guess you'd call it lighter, although if you're in the throes of it, it doesn't feel that way. It's the critters who invade our home, how you deal with them. Steve, it's good to have you with us today on Air Talk.
It's good to be here. I'm ready to share what I know and help anybody who's got a rat problem.
First of all, what response in the couple days since this was published, what response have you had to the column?
Well, the response, it's like the rats. You know, it keeps coming. And every time I check my email, there's more. People with rats in the walls, under the house, in the attic. You know what? A lot of people emailing about rats in their cars and under the hoods.
Cars? Oh, wow.
Yeah, I got a nice one from a guy with a Maserati who had $11,000 in repairs because the rats were chewing the wires.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. Something to keep in mind. You know, so many of us have had run-ins with rats. I'd love to hear from you as an Air Talk listener. If you have a particularly wild story about wildlife, rat, raccoon, opossum, not just the run-of-the-mill, but something truly epic, I would love to hear your account of dealing with the challenge of critters in Southern California. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. One of the challenges can be the potential odor. My first experience of this, as a little kid, I was at my grandparents' house in the View Park area of L.A., and a horrible smell overtook the entire, it's a fairly large house, the entire house because something got into the wall and didn't survive. And you have no choice at that point, unless you're going to take the wall apart. You either have to endure the smell or move out of your house until the thing totally decomposes.
You know, it could become pretty involved. And, you know, speaking of the responses, I got a lot of people talking about dealing with this for years, even though they did what appear to be the right things to do to try to find out what are the entry points. That is key, finding out, okay, how is the rat getting into your house? They're called roof rats. They're known as roof rats, I should say. And a lot of them are getting in under the eaves through openings up on the roof.
But even when people do the right thing and hire somebody who can spot those entry points and screen them off, people tell me that they're thousands of dollars into their battles and years into these battles. So some people are having a bigger problem than I've had so far.
I was fairly lucky. So a few years back, my wife and I started noticing that fruit in the fruit bowl had little gnawing marks on it. Something was eating the fruit. I figured it was roof rats were somehow getting into the house. And I had the darndest time trying to find where the point of entry was. I finally found in the utility area behind the washer and dryer a little tiny little gap between the floor and where the wall came down. And I put steel wool in, was able to, yeah, and that stopped the problem. But it took me weeks to find the point of entry.
Larry, are you available for hire? I mean, it sounds like you've got a lot of experience here.
I do, and I am such a softy when it comes to any animal, even vermin. And so, you know, when I caught the rats that got in, I couldn't bring myself to off them. I just couldn't do it.
So you adopted them? You got a hamster wheel for them?
No, I hired someone to handle that.
Listen, I asked some of the experts I was talking to about that. What, you know, is there something to do other than kill them? And they said, look, these may carry disease. That's one problem. And there's also a fire hazard because when they get into the attic and there are all those wires up there, they like chewing on the wires maybe to sharpen their teeth. Maybe because they think they're roots, and you could put a couple wires together and spark a fire.
I've heard of that happening, even in commercial buildings. I've heard of fires because of the wiring gnawed by rats.
Yeah, so if you catch and release, they may come back. You better watch out.
Yeah, and they're smart. That's the other thing. They're extremely resilient. They're very smart. I think it was in your piece, wasn't it, where the exterminator told you that if a rat sees another rat caught in a trap, they wise up to it?
They will avoid that kind of trap. Yeah, they're really smart.
All right, 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. These got to be good stories, not run-of-the-mill vermin stories, not, you know, run-of-the-mill, but really smart critters and really, you know, intense challenges that you've had to deal with. 866-893-KPCC. Fiona Ng, our senior producer, said when she lived in Silver Lake, she had a problem with rat, but it wasn't the typical case where they only come out when the lights are out. She would be sitting in her living room. A rat would come out and just look up at her, like daring her to do something about. Yeah, see, mine were very timid. They only came out at night. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Marina in Encino, good to have you with us. What's your experience dealing with infestations?
Well, we had skunks one time.
In the house?
And we knew they were there, and I tried to get my husband to go and get them out, and he goes, I'm not going down there. But they woke us up in the middle of the night when they sprayed, and they all came up through the heater vent. And
oh, no.
We couldn't breathe, and we had to cover up all the heater vents because there was a floor vent with towels and rugs. The house smelled like skunk for a week. It was awful.
Were you able to even stay in the house with that kind of odor?
It didn't touch us, but it was... The smell was pretty strong.
Yeah, yeah, because I've had my dog skunked a couple of times. And
yeah, they don't know any better.
Yeah, yeah, and that's bad, bad news.
So we're in the middle of one right now, so it's pretty bad.
All right, Marina, we wish you the best. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. They're also the opossums. They are not native. Well, I guess the rats aren't either, to Southern California. They're marsupials. And I love how they play dead when you know, some sort of predator approaches them. It's quite the act.
You know, I was told by one of those experts, Larry, that one reason I may be having the problem I'm having right now is because it's been cold and it's been wet, and rats seek shelter. They want to go where it's warm.
Understand.
This is a new adventure for me because when I lived in Silver Lake, I spent years battling, and I could identify with Marina there, with skunks and raccoons.
And raccoons digging up your yard.
Right, and I tried everything that was recommended. Coyote urine, rags soaked in ammonia, bars of white ivory soap for some reason. And it would work for a couple of days, and then they'd be onto it and be laughing at me and keep coming.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. So do you feel like you've got a handle on your problem now, Steve?
Well, I called this guy Manny who came out, and he said, here's where I think they're getting in. And so he blocked those off, set traps, and caught a big one and said, within 3 days, the rats should be starved, the ones that are trapped in your house, and they'll go to the peanut butter in the traps. So after 3 days, if you don't have any more, you should be beyond the problem. And so far, so good, but you never know.
All right. Matt D'Angelo Antonio, our producer, said, my challenge is preventing my cat from bringing rats into the house, killing them off in the bathroom, and then all of that being regurgitated. Matt, that is epically disgusting, I have to admit.
Larry, that's also a good reason not to use poison. There are many reasons not to use poisons. You don't want them in your house. You don't want the rats getting them in their systems. And then, you know, the house cat gets the poison. So you got to watch out with that.
Jeff in Pasadena said, I was told by someone to put a bar of Irish Spring under the hood of my car, and it stopped the rats from coming and chewing on the wiring. Have you ever heard?
No, I was told Ivory soap, so maybe okay. Irish Spring works just as well.
Well, certainly Irish Spring has a stronger aroma than Ivory does. So.
Yeah.
How would someone even figure? Why would you? I think I'll put a bar of soap under the hood, see if that stops. Who would even try that? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Scott in downtown LA, welcome.
Thank you. I run the wholesale flower market in downtown LA. Our building's about 100,000 square feet, and we had a pretty severe rodent problem maybe 20 years ago. Tried all the extermination stuff, and then we partnered up with this one animal rescue shelter, and they brought in feral cats, about five of them, and they placed them in around our markets, and ever since then, we no longer have a rodent problem.
I wouldn't have thought that the kinds of flowers you have at the wholesale market attract rodents, but they like to eat the flowers?
They love the sugar, like in carnation stems, and they would actually claw their way through some of our metal refrigerator doors just to get to the flowers.
Amazing. But the feral cats have gotten rid of your problem?
They have, and it's a lot cheaper of a solution because you only have to feed them and put down kitty litter.
Yeah. Scott, thank you. I appreciate it. He manages the downtown wholesale flower market. Rodent problem gone thanks to the feral cats. 866-893-KPCC. Joining us, Steve Lopez, LA Times columnist, wrote recently about his challenge with rats. Prior to that, raccoons. So he's got all kinds of critters he's dealt with over the years, as many of us have. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Film Week coming up in just a few minutes. Greg writes on the AirTalk page, since rat poison was outlawed, a rat infestation and associated disease have increased. Meanwhile, the raptors they were concerned about with the poison have overpopulated and are decimated mockingbirds and other species. I love it when humans get involved in trying to legislate and regulate the natural order. That's Greg writing on the AirTalk page. Well, I don't know how rat poison is part of the natural order. That sounds like a human attempt at a solution. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Citizens LA Wild tweets at AirTalk, a good time to remember the value of coyotes. Rats and fruit make up 90% of their diet. When people want to vilify coyotes, they eat rats. For God's sakes, don't use rat poison. It makes rats harder to eradicate. That's Citizens LA Wild tweeting at AirTalk. Steve Lopez, LA Times columnist with us. What's interesting, people talking about these other, like raptors and coyotes and the like.
Well, I've dealt with a lot of coyotes, too, and that's good advice. You know, if all else fails, you could do what I did in Silver Lake. I hired an animal communicator.
Oh, yes.
Unsurprisingly, there are quite a few of them in L.A., and I got one who said that she was going to be able to communicate with my raccoons and ask them why they were targeting my yard and none of my neighbors' yards. And she got back to me. She sent me the transcript of her conversation with the raccoons. And the raccoons told her that their ancestors were buried in my yard and I wasn't being sensitive enough to the situation.
This is gold for a columnist. I mean, you couldn't... Well worth whatever you paid her. 866-893-KPECC. Surfcraft writes on the page, I was once opening up a wall during a remodel. When I reached the last couple of square feet of drywall in the last stud bay, over a dozen rats poured out of the wall right through us out the door. It was awesome. That's Surfcraft writing on the Air Talk. That sounds like, what was that old movie, Willard?
Yes.
Andrew in Glendale, you're on Air Talk with Steve Lopez.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Hi, Steve. So a couple of years ago, I installed some new turf in my backyard, and apparently raccoons love to dig up that turf because it makes it really easy for them to get to the grubs. So I would come out to see my freshly put in expensive turf, and it would be torn up every single morning, and I'd put it back very carefully. And so eventually I started putting blankets and chairs down to see if that would stop them. That didn't stop them. I sprayed down the whole yard with like $50 worth of cayenne pepper because Annette told me that would work. I used coyote urine, and they just seemed to like it more.
You need the communicator like Steve used.
But you know what? You hit upon a key here. They're after the grubs with skunks and with raccoons. The reason they keep digging it up is not just to, you know, to drive you crazy. They're going after those fat worms that are under that turf, and they're always there with new turf. So you gotta use grub killer, but then you're dealing with poisons. So sometimes there just are no solutions.
Our engineer, Ethan, saying I had a rat cause $1,000 worth of damage to my Mercedes. The dealership told me I got lucky. The damage was so minimal.
Well, you know, they go to the under the hoods because it's warm. So when they're cold, you better, I don't know, park your car somewhere else. We'd be remiss, Larry, in not pointing out that there is currently a rat infestation at L.A. City Hall. It made the news this week.
They're talking about pulling all the carpeting up.
They are. And given our experience, yours and mine, we should apply for that pest control contract. But I don't know that I've made enough campaign donations to the right people.
I can't imagine. Yeah, behested payments. You know, I can't imagine what the cost is going to be if they're going to recarpet all of City Hall after this related to the typhus outbreak.
Right. They might be better with feral cats.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting. I have the cats sitting on a city council business. Let's take another call. This is from Nick in Hollywood. Nick, your experience with critters.
Well, I have two very unusual ones, Larry. I own a retail store on La Brea. It's so funny because Steve Lopez did an article on us. The first one is I bought a very elaborate system that was ultrasound. I spent a lot of money, and the very next day I came to work and all the cords had been chewed up.
Great irony. I love it.
$400 or something. Then my other story is we had a pet bird, and by the grace of God, he wasn't hiding. But these rats got into a one-inch space between the bars. Thank God, ate all the seed, but did not harm the bird. I couldn't believe they could squeeze through that little one-inch space.
And that, Nick, and that's the amazing thing. And Steve, that little gap in between my wall and floor was so tiny, I would never guess a big rat could get through.
They're like little Houdinis, you know. Sometimes just a little sliver of space, like under your kitchen cabinets, and they make it in and out of there.
Austin in Sierra Madre said, we have bears that get into our trash. We're backed up to the mountains. I have to bake in time to every morning my commute to come out, clean up all the trash that they've pulled out of the cans. Austin, I think I'd consider one of those bear-proof, but you'd have to transfer it, I guess, to the regular city-provided cans for the truck to get them. But you know, a lot of the mountain communities, they have the bear-proof push-button cans because of that. Steve, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Anything you learn more, you'll share with us, I trust?
I certainly will. We're living in a jungle.
All right. Steve Lopez, LA Times columnist, joining us on Air Talk. Molly in Granada Hills says, I bought a half house cat, half serval cat from Africa to get rid of rats. Came with a money back guarantee. Rat jumped up the wall. Cat grabbed it. Did a particularly violent thing to the rat. No more rats after they witnessed that. Thank you, Molly.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering 3 psychology master's degrees during the summer term. Convenient locations for working professionals in West LA, Encino, and Irvine. Graduates in psychology, marriage and family therapy, and behavioral psychology are prepared to pursue licensure or a doctorate in their designated field. Classes start in April. Apply by February 15th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Just a reminder, we're just over a week away from the 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview at the Theater at Ace Hotel, Sunday afternoon, February 17th. Sure hope to see you there. Tickets available, kpcc.org/in-person. The 3 critics joining me today will all be on stage along with their peers. With me today, film critic Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, and Claudia Puig. She's the top one at the LA Film Critics Association, president of the group, which just gave out its prestigious critical awards. We begin with The Lego Movie 2. The second part stars Chris Pratt, Elizabeth Banks, Will Arnett, directed by Mike Mitchell. In the sequel, the citizens of Bricksburg are facing a huge new threat, Lego Duplo invaders from outer space, wrecking everything faster than they can rebuild.
We are from the planet Duplo, and we are here to destroy you.
Hello, visitors from another planet.
There's no need to fight anymore.
See? Friends.
Ooh.
Run! The Lego Movie 2, the second part, Charles.
Well, the first Lego Movie was fresh and funny and subversive. It was visually imaginative. It was a really exciting, fun film that we all loved. But since then, we've had Lego Ninjago and Lego Batman, and the Teen Titans movie was milking a very similar brand of comedy. And so some of the bloom has come off, and this new film is very talky. It has some very unnecessary songs that, while they may be catchy, they don't do anything to advance the story. It feels much more like a big toy commercial. And one big problem I had with it is it's predicated on what seem to be very outdated gender stereotypes. Little girls like hearts and stars and glitter and everything to be pink, and boys like explosions and superheroes and spaceships. And that seems to me a really unworthy premise for something to follow up to something so imaginative as the first one. There's more live action. And the basic message is go play with your sister the way she wants to play, with a lot of elements stolen from Toy Story 3. Particularly the sequence of them playing is just Andy and Bonnie, you know, just before he goes away to college. There are some other sequences that owe very heavily to the Toy Story. It just didn't do much for me.
Claudia, what'd you think?
I felt similarly. It felt frenetic to me and sort of chock full of pop culture references that weren't particularly clever or funny. It was predictable. I really liked the first one. I did feel like this was kind of a giant commercial for Legos. In fact, I even felt there might have been a commercial for Carl's Jr. and one of the stars.
Yeah.
Looked exactly like that logo. I don't know if they're like doing the you know,
the crossover
toys and stuff. But, you know, the message was about holding on to your inner sweetness. It was a little heavy-handed, a little obvious. I did like some of the characters. I like one of the main female characters, who is played by Elizabeth Banks. And One of the problems I had was that they interspersed live action a little bit too much. The first one brought it in at the very end with Will Ferrell, which I thought worked really well as the father-son thing. This one, you have Maya Rudolph as the mom and the kids. It's kind of interspersed all the way through, so it feels a little bit muddled. It doesn't have the big reveal.
A really thankless role for her.
Yes.
Well, part of the problem, too, is that that twist at the end of the first Lego movie is so profound.
Yes.
The fact that everything we had just seen is like the imagination of the little boy, and then when you realize, oh, this is him playing in his basement, like Will Ferrell is actually president of business, like that is it's stunning. Like I cried at the end of the first Lego movie. This already has that built in, and yeah, they do go back and forth too frequently between the animation and the live action. It kind of messes with the pacing of it. And there's some jokes that just they go to over and over again, like the banana tripping on its own peel wasn't really all that funny the first time. Charles, you didn't like the songs. I love the songs this time. They are so fun. And yeah, it is still live, high energy, and it's zippy, and you can't catch all the pop culture references the first time around. I had a really good time, but nothing could ever compare with the ingenuity and just the infectiousness of that first one.
And part of what was so great about the first one, I think, is I remember us talking about it beforehand, like with low expectations, like a Lego movie. How stupid is that? And the movie was so inventive, was so funny, and had such an edge to it. I think that's hard to get back.
Kind of what Phil Lord and Chris Miller do so well. You know, when we all saw 21 Jump Street, we thought, "What's that's going to be?" And they surprised us, and it was wonderful and inventive. And I think that now our standards are so high for Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
They also did most of the work on Spider-Man.
Yes, Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah. I think you had a similar problem with Incredibles 2, that was the film that showed us how to animate human characters in CG without them looking like waxworks. Turn them into a cartoon, exaggerate the designs, exaggerate the movements, and they come alive. And so the second one was not the revelation the first one was. And I think what we're all saying is that that's true of this too. The first one was so good and a revelation in its way, so imaginative in its visuals, that they can't live up to it.
We're talking about the Lego Movie 2, the second part, directed by Mike Mitchell, written by Phil Lord, Christopher Miller, Matthew Fogel, and Raphael Bob Waxberg. It's rated PG in wide release. The comedy What Men Want stars Taraji P. Henson, Adam Shankman, the director. It's a gender-flipped version of the 2000 release What Women Want, a woman in this film developing the ability to hear men's thoughts.
I feel weird after last night.
Yeah, that's what happens when tequila meets desperation.
Okay, stop doing that.
Stop doing what?
Talking without moving your mouth and saying things you shouldn't be saying to your boss.
I swear on my life I would never say anything disrespectful or inappropriate to you, ever.
Which is more than I can say for you.
Right there. You just did it. You said more than I can say for you. I heard you say
it. But I didn't say it. Holy crap. Can you hear my inner thoughts?
I can hear your inner thoughts!
Taraji P. Henson is Mel Gibson in What Men Want. Claudia, what do you think?
Well, I liked her better than Mel Gibson, I'll say that. It's kind of muddled. I mean, it has, I won't say it's certainly not a success, but it's not a complete failure either. I think that she's energetic and sparkly, and I like Taraji P. Henson. It's a little, the tone shifts a little bit. At first I thought, I was really heartened because I thought, okay, here's a film that's taking on what it's like to be a woman of color in an industry that's dominated by white males. And you know, she's going up against a boys club.
Agent, right?
She's a sports agent. And everybody else, you know, who's a sports agent in that particular firm is a man and white. I think there might be a couple of black guys, but they don't figure into it. And in that vein, it seemed like there might be some empowerment. And there were moments of that. On the other hand, it sort of went in another direction by the end, or the third act, which is like taming a career woman. All she really needs is a good man and she needs to be nicer. And so it kind of felt like it might have had some sharpness and some bite and ended up being defanged. And she's great, but I really felt like the pop culture references weren't great. The humor was spotty at best. It just didn't work ultimately, but there were some moments that I thought worked.
It's extremely hit and miss.
Yes.
Like the things that you can hear the men thinking are a lot of the times so mundane, like, did I leave the coffee pot on?
Where are my socks?
Right, and that's supposed to be funny, like, okay, not all men's thoughts are shocking or inappropriate, like sometimes they are just like the stuff of daily life, but it's so hit and miss, and she is so charismatic, and she makes terrible film choices. Why is that? Over and over again, like Proud Mary. Was it 2 Januaries ago, last January? I don't know what Taraji's thinking when she says yes to these scripts, because she's got charisma for days and she can play every kind of character. And here, I guess it seemed like a fun showcase and a big arc because it's a very physical role. It's a very broad comedy. And she's got these wacky gaggle of friends who are essentially interchangeable. They're all sort of the same person. And then there's a whole thing with Erykah Badu as the psychic.
That was kind of funny because she plays this like weed-obsessed psychic who's tea may or may not be the reason why she can read men's thoughts.
Right, she's like a manicurist slash pot dealer slash psychic. And I feel like a lot of that must have just been improvised. And then they let her go loose and then just didn't rein her in. This movie is about 2 hours long and it just keeps not ending. Like repeatedly think, okay, we've reached a sensible conclusion here. And then there's more. And then there's more resolution. Like, okay, we get it. So not the best from Taraji here.
That's too bad. As you say, she's so talented and has such charisma on screen.
Totally. Yes.
That she needs roles worthy of that talent. What Men Want is the new film in which she stars. Adam Shankman, the director, Tina Gordon Chisholm, Peter Hike, and Alex Gregory are the screenwriters. It's rated R in wide release. High Flying Bird is the new Steven Soderbergh film starring Andre Holland and Zazie Beetz, Melvin Gregg in the cast, all filmed on an iPhone. High Flying Bird. Christy, what do you think?
This is probably the best movie of the week, I would say, and this is available on Netflix, so you can watch it right now after you listen to our broadcast, of course.
Watch it on your phone.
Yes, you could. And this is the second film that Soderbergh has made on his phone. He did Unsane a year ago with Claire Foy. And the imagination that Soderbergh brings to every project, he seems so free here with the movement that an iPhone allows him. And it looks pretty great. I mean, it looks very slick. And you would never know it was shot in an iPhone unless we just told you. This is the second movie in a row about a sports agent trying to secure the number one NBA draft pick.
I saw them back to back, so wow. I was confusing plot points.
it's so good. It's slick. Terrell Alvin McCraney wrote the script. He's the Oscar winner who wrote Moonlight. And there's such a snappiness to the dialogue and a briskness to the way that Soderbergh edits these scenes. Andre Holland and Zazie Beetz together are amazing. They have tremendous chemistry as this agent and his assistant. And it feels slick and zippy and fun, but it's got so much to say about capitalism. And it's sort of an allegory about the NBA as a modern day form of slavery, with these young men just being exploited for their abilities and the fat cat owners reaping all of the rewards of it. Also, Sonia Son is great as the head of the Players Association, who is negotiating on behalf of the players during this lockout. This is dazzling.
I wouldn't think of NBA players as being a naturally sympathetic for financial reasons group.
They are. They're broke in this movie.
There are actual real NBA athletes. Reggie Jackson, Carl Anthony Towns, Donovan Mitchell. They have this little segment where they're being interviewed in a black and white. And that's a really nice counterpoint to what's going on. Andre Holland, of course, was in Moonlight. And he's fantastic. And he was also in The Nick, which is another Soderbergh project. And he's fantastic in this, as is Zazie Beetz. And it's kind of a classic Soderbergh construct, because, you know, when you think about like Aaron Brockovich and even Magic Mike, he likes telling stories of like individuals who are kind of going up against the status quo. So it's in that vein. I think the pairing of him with Terrell Alvin McCraney is inspired. It's such a beautiful, sharp, layered script. It kind of brings in almost Shakespeare and sort of moments that feel almost, you know, like a church sermon, with like, you know, very snappy dialogue. And it's delivered so well by the actors. It's really great.
Bill Duke is really great also,
yes,
as the basketball coach up in the Bronx.
When is like Bill Duke not always?
Yes, always, yeah, always. It's a tremendous cast.
Yeah.
High Flying Bird is the film from director Steven Soderbergh. Terrell Alvin McCraney, the screenwriter. It's unrated. It's streaming on Netflix. You can also see it on the big screen at Limley's NoHo in North Hollywood. It's unrated. We'll also just quickly get started on Cold Pursuit, which is an action thriller starring Liam Neeson and Laura Dern. Hans Petter Moland, the director. Christy?
This is a remake of a Norwegian film, which I actually had the pleasure of talking about on Film Week when it came out.
You get to do both.
Full circle.
I have. Yeah. And the same director, Moland, directs this English language version. And what happens, I feel, frequently when foreign language directors then direct an English language remake of their own work is that something gets lost in the translation. And that is what happened here. The dark humor that made that film really daring and really strange and really cool just somehow just gets lost here. And we have Liam Neeson playing yet another vengeful dad figure.
Turns out he's really like that too.
That's a whole other conversation to have. But yeah. He's a snowplow driver, and he goes on this killing spree to avenge what has happened to his son. And he goes after all these various drug gangs, going up and up the ladder until he gets to the final, you know, drug kingpin that he's after. And it's really violent and really bleak, and just feels kind of flat. We've seen Liam Neeson do this kind of role so many times and so much better, and this just feels disappointing.
The film Cold Pursuit, it's in wide release, rated R. The screenplay is written by Frank Baldwin, based on the Norwegian film In Order of Disappearance. Much more to come on Film Week. We'll hear from our critics. Also take a look at the Oscar-nominated shorts. It's Film Week on KPCC. A wonderful actor, Albert Finney, passed away this morning at the age of 82, going all the way back to Tom Jones, in which he was the title character. But, you know, so many terrific performances over the years. You remember Scrooge? He was Ebenezer Scrooge in that film, Murder on the Orient Express. And you know, the movies went on and on up until more recent one. He was Daddy Warbucks in 1982's Annie. Man with a very, very long and distinguished career in film, and came up with other top British actors, you know, people like Alan Bates and others of that generation. We were out to dinner. We were in Hawaii. We were on Maui and out at a nice restaurant, and Finney happened to be at the next table with his manager at the time. And so we struck up a conversation. We rode back after dinner together. And, you know, I knew his reputation being quite the ladies' man and all. He was so charming, I thought I was losing my wife. In a 20-minute car ride, I thought, Kristen, well, I'd lost her. Albert Finney has my wife.
Yeah.
Exactly. I didn't know whether to feel bad about it or
or just trade it up.
Yeah.
He was under the volcano. Remember how great he was.
He's such a delightful person.
That Tom Jones is still just such an iconic, the famous eating scene in that.
Yes.
You don't forget it.
Absolutely. So our condolences to his family, but a big loss to cinema as well. Very talented actor. We continue on Film Week. Our critics this week are Claudia Puig, Christy Lemire, and Charles Solomon. Everybody Knows stars Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem. The film written and directed by Asghar Farhadi, the Iranian director. Claudia, what'd you think of Everybody Knows?
I love Asghar Farhadi, I should say. I really loved A Separation, which won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. I liked Salesman a lot. I liked another film that he did called The Past. I liked this one a little bit less than those others, but I still I thought the performances were great. He's just so astute with domestic dramas and the way he kind of examines small problems that kind of blow up into bigger issues. And they almost feel like psychological thrillers when they sometimes spark from, you know, just a discussion or, you know, misunderstanding or something. Here, it's almost the opposite, where he starts with a bigger issue. And I don't think it's giving anything away to say there's an abduction. I'll just say that. And then he goes to the smaller problems or the things that are bubbling under the surface. So it kind of is a different direction for him. And of course, it's the first time he's shot in Spain with all Spanish actors in Spanish. And it felt very atmospheric and evocative. You have Javier Bardem, Penelope Cruz, a very famous Argentine actor, Ricardo Darín. The acting is fantastic. And to me, that's what makes it worthwhile. It kind of drags a little, and it You don't have sort of the gripping sense of suspense that you do in some of his other films. So it's not the best of Farhadi, but even a lesser Farhadi is better than most films.
And how's Madrid? I mean, is it the city?
It's just outside
well?
Of Madrid. Oh, okay. It's like a small town, a village. And it's you really get a sense of Spain. Apparently he lived there for 2 years to really get a sense of the place before he was making the film. And I loved hearing the Spanish, and I love, seeing all these fantastic Spanish actors. Javier Bardem is a little bit hammy, but that's kind of his part. And it's a tale of, like, love and crime and family squabbles, and you really get the sense of place with it, too. So I liked it.
Everybody knows. Christy, what'd you think?
Yeah, the sense of place is definitely one of the stronger elements of it. Just the observant way in which he'll notice people hanging out of their windows or, like, sitting at a table at a cafe and everyone's watching everybody else. And you get this insularity, the sense that it is this kind of claustrophobic small town in which everybody does know what everyone else is doing. When it is a character drama, when it is playing to Farhadi's strengths, it is great. It is gripping. And the resentments and the secrets and the regrets that are like bubbling beneath the surface until they finally explode, that's all interesting. The actual crime, the actual whodunit, feels very mundane to me by comparison and not nearly as intriguing. And I didn't know who it was. I was surprised to find out why things went down the way
but
that they did.
But it wasn't very exciting.
But then I was like, oh, yeah. That's it? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem, although they don't play a married couple here, they play a couple that has a past from their youth. And they have, of course, tremendous, crazy chemistry with each other. And it's always a joy to watch them. It's a very showy part for Penelope Cruz, a big arc she has to play.
A lot of crying.
But she shows up and she's like, she's radiant to be back home with her family in her hometown. And then, like, she undergoes a big, significant transformation as the film goes on. And that's exciting to watch.
And the people who play her sisters actually look like her, too.
Yeah,
I was going to say, one of the things that I think about Farhadi as a director that he does so well is he does that relational stuff where it's not explicit. It's just sort of implied.
Yes.
And he shows in the way that characters just sort of move about, even mundane things, what's beneath the surface. And that's a gift. That's very hard to do on film.
Absolutely. He never bothers with exposition. You know, things are unraveled. The layers are peeled back. And you get that here, too.
Everybody knows the latest from Asghar Farhadi, the director and writer of the film. It's rated R. It's at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot.
best title.
The Oscar for best title goes to stars Sam Elliott, Aidan Turner, and Ron Livingston. The film is written and directed by Robert D. Krzyzkowski. Christy, what'd you think of The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot?
Well, if anybody can do all that, it's Sam Elliott, right? Like, nobody else can pull off all that. So this is a kind of a weird mishmash of stuff, as the title itself might suggest. There's a lot going on here. Sam Elliott plays a man who is, you know, at the end of his life, and he's got some regrets and got some remorse, and there's some introspection going on. He's living in a small town, and it flashes back to when he was younger and going off to World War II. This takes place, like, in, like, the early 80s. And so it flashes back to when he's going off to World War II and the training he receives to kill Hitler. This assumes that he's a dude who assassinated Hitler, and that's what brought World War II to an end. Hooray! And then another assignment comes his way from a very shadowy government figure played by Ron Livingston, that he's got to go kill Bigfoot now, because Bigfoot is the carrier of this major viral disease that is, like, wiping out entire populations. And so, like, if anyone's going to do it, it's going to be this guy. And it's the conflict he feels within himself. It's far more gripping as an understated character study than it is as this wild B movie. Like, you see,
and it's all done straight.
Yes, it is not a comedy.
With a title like that, you really want it to be a comedy.
I mean, like,
guess. Well, it is in the story.
Maybe Bigfoot is a metaphor for something. I don't know. It's not really Bigfoot. It's our own internal personal Bigfoot.
Our athlete's feet.
It's a very popular one, because we had Smallfoot last year.
We did.
There's a Bigfoot movie from Laika coming out this year, and there's
the
a couple of others in the works. Yeah. So apparently we're in a Bigfoot era.
Yes, but the director is smart enough to let Sam Elliott just be Sam Elliott on screen quite frequently, and that's quite compelling.
Yeah, he's another one of those people who's always great, whatever right? he's in. The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot is unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, and the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana. Untogether stars Jemima Kirk, Lola Kirk, and Jamie Dornan. The film written and directed by Emma Forrest. Claudia?
Well, this film follows several screwed up, kind of trendy, sort of aging hipster Angelinos that you really don't care about. So that's a problem to start. it's a real hearty endorsement. You have a few intriguing moments between Jamie Dornan and Jemima Kirk. Jamie Dornan is, not trying to get anybody to indulge in 50 Shades of Grey, so that's nice. It's awkwardly paced. It's kind of, the stories are one. Billy Crystal plays a rabbi, and he feels like he came in from another movie. I don't even know why he's there. Well, I do know why he's there, but it's people are looking for love, and they're looking for spiritual sustenance, and it feels forced. It feels kind of like indie cliched. It didn't work for me.
Yeah, there are some individual moments that do work. And Jemima Kirk and Lola Kirk are sisters, and so they obviously have a nice, easy way with each other. I enjoyed Jamie Dornan using his own Irish accent.
Yes, that's always nice.
That made him a lot more, like, why couldn't they have made Christian Grey Irish? Like, how much sexier would Christian Grey have been?
Because the Irish would have been up in arms.
Right. I guess. But you realize, when he's speaking his accent, I get it now. Oh, okay, this is why they cast him. There are some individual moments, but they're all such cliches. They're all such types. Ben Mendelsohn is in this, and we see him from behind his bare butt for the first time we see him, and he's like this aging rock star. Everyone's kind of a type.
He was married to the writer-director.
He's married to the writer-director. That's their divorce. See his naked butt in the beginning of it. But yeah, this just feels like there's like a whole subgenre of indie of like lost Angelinos trying to find each other. And
exactly.
This is one of them.
It's kind of mumblecore, but whatever, yeah.
Untogether, rated R, Arclight, Sherman Oaks, Berlin, I Love You, which is a German-Austrian-U.S. co-production, the romantic comedy starring Keira Knightley, Helen Mirren, Luke Wilson, Jim Sturgess, Mickey Rourke, many more. And it has multiple directors and multiple screenwriters. Berlin, I Love You. Claudia.
It has multiple stories and none of them are interesting. It's, Berlin deserves better. It's uneven. It's limp. It's, these anthologies, they had Paris Je T'aime, they had New York, I Love You, they had Rio. This is the fifth and none of us can remember the fourth. So we figure it was Topeka or something. But in any event, this one just, I don't know why they don't work. You think they might work. And I think with the first one that I remember, which was Paris Je T'aime, I think that was the first one, you had like the Coen brothers and you had some really interesting filmmakers contributing. And I think successively you have less and less interesting filmmakers. You have some great actors in this, Helen Mirren and Keira Knightley. This is probably the most interesting vignette. You have Diego Luna in a transgender role. You have, interesting possibilities and they just don't come together. It feels very forced and artificial. There's the one that's particularly awful with Mickey Rourke and this blonde that he meets at a bar and he's trying to seduce. And there's possibly she may be his daughter. And it's just icky. It just, it makes you, I know, exactly. You find yourself recoiling as you're watching it. So, ich nein bin a Berliner.
Berlin, I Love You, not. Rated R at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. The Amityville Murders takes us back to the familiar horror story. Daniel Farrens, the writer-director, John Robinson, and Chelsea Ricketts star. Christy?
This is an origin story. Every superhero gets one. Now, horror movies are getting them now, apparently, as well. These are the murders that took place in the house where Amityville Horror then ended up taking place. Of course, it's all based on a true story. We find out what it is that drove Ronald DeFeo Jr., Butch DeFeo, to kill his entire family. And it's It's atmospheric and moody here and there. Some of the editing is kind of frenetic. It is deeply steeped in like cheesy 70s polyester culture. Diane Franklin, who was like an 80s darling in movies like Better Off Dead and The Last American Virgin, now plays the mom here of this whole family. And she's really over the top. She's doing this very broad kind of New York Italian accent. And it is how this young man, played by John Robinson, slowly loses his mind and begins hearing noises, and he's paranoid. But there's some ambiguity to that because he does a lot of drugs, and his father is extraordinarily abusive of him. So there are a lot of factors at play here that might push him over the edge. Whatever the combination of stuff was, he gets a shotgun and kills everybody. The end. Oh, boy.
Anxious to go see that, too. The Amityville Murders, unrated, the horror film at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'll be back with our trio of critics right after this. One of the highlights of the years for me is being in the presence of all of our Film Week critics on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel. I love working with them every week on the program, but there's something about the energy of getting them all together in one place, seeing the camaraderie and the gentle teasing and the fun that goes on between our critics. It's really a delight. It's so much fun for me to do the program. And if you've been in the past, I know you know what a fun afternoon it is. We have tickets left for next weekend, Sunday, February 17th, 17th Annual Film Week Academy Awards Preview. Get your tickets, kpecc.org/in-person. We show clips of all the Oscar-nominated films on the really big screen there at the Ace, and our critics talk about all the major categories. We continue with this week's films, joined by critics Christy Lemire, Charles Solomon, and Claudia Puig. The Prodigy, Taylor Schilling, Jackson Robert Scott star, Nicholas Schilling McCarthy, and Jeff Bueller, the director and writer, respectively. Claudia?
Well, we were speaking of horror tropes, and this is yet another one. It's a variation on The Bad Seed, The Omen. It's the scary little genius boy. There's the scary little girl, and this is the scary little boy. And then you add the sort of psycho killer sort of overlay of that, and their identities meld in a very sort of hocus-pocus-y kind of supernatural way. There are moments, there's, you know, sort of typical things like jump scares, and there are a couple of moments in which it works. And the idea is, you know, as one is born, the other, as one dies, the other one is born. And so he, this creepy little boy, grows up to do all kinds of things that should tell you. He tortures his babysitter, flies, buzz around. He sings a creepy little tune. He speaks Hungarian in his sleep. Hmm. So that's always a sign. Yes. If your child does that, you know,
get him off
good
to the
sign.
Therapist.
Yes. Anyway, it's, you know, it's sometimes suspenseful. Build up is really most of the fun, and it's not great. It's, you know, I would say go back and watch The Omen or The Bad Seed.
The Prodigy is the film. The director, I misstated his name, Nicholas McCarthy. Jeff Bueller, the screenwriter. It's rated R in wide release. Under the Eiffel Tower, a romantic comedy starring Matt Walsh and Judy Godrej. Archie Borders is the director and co-screenwriter. Christy?
This is a white man having a midlife crisis movie, which is never terribly interesting.
You know, I remember saying on this show, I'm so over middle-aged white men and their midlife crises. And I remember Larry saying, we're not.
Well, here's
we
another.
We never tire of that subject. Yes.
Well, yeah. So, and this one asks us to accept Matt Walsh as a romantic lead, which would be fine if he were given more to play. He's a jumble of contradictions and quirks and character traits that never quite add up. Like he's kind of selfish and kind of immature. He's
unlikable.
He is. He is a bourbon salesman, whiskey salesman.
Yes,
bourbon,
he's a
right?
bourbon salesman. And does a lot of bourbon drinking.
Right. And out of nowhere, he asks his best friend's 24-year-old daughter to marry him under the Eiffel Tower when he joins them for a trip to Paris, and that sends him reeling. But then he meets this woman who saves him, who runs this beautiful vineyard,
he's
who is Jodie Godrej.
Him.
Yeah, she's young and she's beautiful.
And she has a husband.
Oh, That was a spoiler.
Ooh, sorry.
Yes, Gary Cole's in
perfect.
It. Gary Cole's in it, and it just never gels. You know, it's never that funny, never that romantic.
It's very contrived.
Some of the scenery is nice.
Well, it's France.
It's
so,
France.
Yeah,
it's
why
the
not?
French countryside. It's yeah. a vineyard in the French countryside. Can't really go wrong there.
Right.
You know, seriously, one of the problems I have with the midlife crisis genre, as I'm not really a fan, is that it sort of excuses
bad behavior
under and I find it very difficult to relate to the men in this position because they're acting with such typical disregard for everybody around them.
That's exactly right, and this is a perfect case of that too. Okay, since I've already spoiled it, I'm so sorry, everyone.
Go ahead, just rip the band.
Millions of heartbroken listeners.
Yes, they're all coming with pitchforks. Gary Cole plays her mate, and he's in a wheelchair. And so he gets sort of cuckolded. And so what is that saying about disabled people, that they're kind of, you know, sexless? And so that's insulting on many levels. And the fact that there's this guy is willing to do that is also makes him very unlikable. And the fact that he proposed to this woman, you know, who's half his age for no real good reason. He spent $7,000 on a diamond ring, and then because he'd been fired, no one really explained. It's all very contrived and cringe inducing, and yeah.
Also, Reed Scott is the Scottish soccer player becomes his wingman, and he's even more obnoxious
they
than Matt Walsh is.
Yeah.
But I think we're supposed to think these guys are kind of hilarious and adorable. But they're not.
Under the Eiffel Tower, Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, it's unrated. 1 Million American Dreams, a documentary directed by Brendan Byrne. Charles?
Well, this is a potentially interesting subject. In the last 150 years, 1 million impoverished and unknown people have been buried on Hart Island, in the river off New York City. But they don't tell you what would make it interesting. There are lots of cliched shots of people walking around New York. There are portentous monologues about there's economic inequality in New York. Well, boy, what a surprise. About an hour into it, they start getting into what should really be the story, which is how this one man got lost in the paperwork and ended up at a medical school and then buried there, and his family couldn't find out what happened to him. But it's too late to start that. So it's just not that interesting.
1 Million American Dreams, unrated, Lemley's Music Hall Theater. Also a screening this week are the Oscar-nominated shorts. Every year gives moviegoers a chance to see the best animated shorts, the best documentary shorts, as well as the best dramatic shorts. And Charles, why don't you start us off with the animated films? We've got Bao, Weekends, Animal Behavior, Late Afternoon, and One Small Step. Which of the films stood out for you?
Well, all of these are good, but there's nothing like Dear Basketball was last year that stands out, that excites you about the use of the animation and so forth. Bao, I think, is the likely winner. It's the very charming story of the Chinese mother's separation anxiety. It screened with Incredibles 2, so it had the largest audience. It's a good film, no question. Weekends is more of a favorite with the artsier crowd. It's very stylized, very brooding about a little boy caught between his divorced parents that he has to go back and forth. And in some ways, the backgrounds are the most interesting part of that one.
This one's hand-drawn.
Mm. Yeah.
It's beautifully, painterly.
Yeah. Animal Behavior is by Alison Snowden and David Fine, who did the one white midlife male crisis film that I love, which is Bob's Birthday, which won the Oscar and is hilarious. And this is kind of funny, but it's not on that level. Late Afternoon is an Irish film about a woman coping with Alzheimer's. That's nice. And One Small Step is about a patient, gentle Chinese father helping his daughter realize her dream to be an astronaut. And it feels like a really good student film to me. I think Bao will win, but none of these really excited me.
Claudia, what do you think about these five nominated animated shorts?
I would say Bao is my favorite, too. I did like Late Afternoon quite a bit, this Irish film that was about a daughter and her mother who had Alzheimer's and sort of the moments of clarity that the mother has and the sweet, tender moments. I like the painterly animation on Weekends. I was not particularly a fan of Animal Behavior. I was, I guess, a little underwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What did you think, Christy?
I love Bao as well, and I sobbed
so
like a ninny. It was not pretty.
Any mom would.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Once you realize what's happening in Bao, like, oh, that's what the dumplings are. Oh, okay, I get it. But I really loved Weekends. I was really taken by it, and it is so strange. Like, it's unsettling in the look of it, and you really feel this child's isolation and his confusion as he goes back and forth between both parents, and the backgrounds, as you say, are so starkly different from each other. That maybe might be a sneaky win for this. It's so good. Animal Behavior, my 9-year-old son loved, and he wants to watch it. It's a bunch of farm animals in therapy, and they're hilarious. Like it's
funny
really
premise.
It's
yeah.
very funny, and they are each who you might expect them to be. Like, there's a parasite. There's a pig who keeps sneaking food. It's cute. It's very cute. Late afternoon, you put it nicely, Charles. It's nice. One small step, also nice.
All right. Yeah, should mention. Oh,
I was going to say the other thing about Weekends is no dialogue.
Oh, right.
It's music and the imagery, which is powerful.
Weekends is from filmmaker Trevor Jimenez. Domi Shi is the filmmaker behind Bao. Allison Snowden, David Fine did Animal Behavior. Late Afternoon from Louise Bagnall. And One Small Step, Andrew Chesworth, Bobby Pontias, and Shafu Shang. More to come on Film Week. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Christy Lemire, Claudia Puig, and Charles Solomon. We're talking about the Oscar-nominated shorts, which are playing in selected theaters over this weekend into next week as well. We just talked about the animated shorts. Now it's the documentary shorts. And we've got five nominees once again. Black Sheep, which is a British documentary. Lifeboat, which tells about a German nonprofit and its volunteers. Period, End of Sentence, which is a documentary set in Delhi, India. Endgame, and A Night at the Garden, which is Madison Square Garden 1939 event. So let me start with you, Christy, on this. Which were your highlights among the docs?
I really like Black Sheep best. It couldn't be more relevant, sadly, in its story of racism and violence. It is about a young man whose family moves from London, from like a high rise in London, out to an estate more in a country type area in Essex. And it's how he's like the only black kid there in an area that's totally overrun with these racist white kids who control the place. And he increasingly discovers that if he assimilates himself with them, he will be safe. And he begins to crave their validation. It's really fascinating in the complexity of its motivations. And they have several recreations to establish moments that we don't actually have on camera. But the interviews are quite powerful with the young man who this happened to. Lifeboat's really good, too. Lifeboat's also, sadly, very relevant as far as its tale of refugees, you know, doing what they must to survive and find a better life. Period, End of Sentence actually has a Southern California tie. It was partly created with a Kickstarter from kids at Oakwood School.
Oh, wow.
Here in Los Angeles.
And is also very relevant with the news from Nepal.
It is, and it's about, women.
Lisa Tabak was the producer at Netflix.
There you go. Women who, start making maxi pads and sharing them and selling them to teach women that there's no stigma attached to this thing that happens to all of us, which is natural, which is
this in rural India.
Yes. And women are frightened to even say the word in the beginning of the film. Endgame is very sad. It's people at the end of their life dying from cancer, trying to find quieter, different ways to live out those last best days of their life. And A Night at the Garden is barely even a movie. I don't even know how it made it into this category. It's really interesting archival footage of a white nationalist rally that took place at Madison Square Garden in 1939, but there is no context. There is nothing. It's just 7 minutes of raw footage. I don't know how it made it into this category.
It's weird that they didn't at least bookend context for it, Charles.
It should have been one of, if not the most interesting film, because it's this rare footage that was somehow preserved. But as Christy was saying, there's no context. It's just these clips of this rally at Madison Square Garden. I also liked Black Sheep, but as we were saying last week, I think we need another term to describe documentaries that are largely recreations, as opposed, say, to Lifeboat, which is footage on a boat that rescues immigrants who are trying to leave Libya and are just crowded like I don't know what onto these tiny craft that are beginning to sink. And this German volunteer group comes to rescue them to get them to safety. Endgame is very San Francisco. with all these,
this is the end of life.
Yeah, the touchy feely kinds of things. It's not a bad film. I suspect it will be either Black Sheep or Lifeboat because of their relevance.
All right. We're talking about the best short documentary category. Those films, again, you can see them in select theaters. And for live action, the best short films, we've got Skin, Marguerite, Madre, Fauve, and Detainment. Claudia, let me start with you. Your pick, favorite out of the live action shorts.
I actually, strangely, I really liked Madre. It's about, you just have this woman on screen in this kind of one-sided phone conversation, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's very suspenseful. She's increasingly growing distraught and anxious, and it's kind of a tour de force in this performance, in this sort of unusual venue of somebody on the phone. I also liked Skin quite a bit. We have Danielle McDonald in that, who is in Patty Cakes and Dumplin'. And it's powerful and disturbing. It's about these skinheads that brutally beat a black man outside of a market just for being black. And then sort of you see a revenge scenario there. It feels like one of those things that's like a calling card for making a full film.
Well, he did, actually.
That's what I thought.
It played at Toronto. It's coming out later this year. It's a full-length film.
Is it also called Skin?
It is.
Yeah.
And Danielle McDonald's also in that, as well as Vera Farmiga and Jamie Bell.
Right.
Mary Stuart Masterson, Bill Camp. So, yeah, so that it is exactly.
So this is the genesis of it.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Now,
which a lot of these films, I think you can say, feel like that they are calling cards.
Yes.
Or resume pieces.
Particularly in this category. I think that's true.
There's one with an older woman and her caregiver that's quite touching and sort of kind of calls upon the sexuality that she once, you know, may have had or maybe didn't allow herself to have as she's in her final days. She's very ill and she has this caregiver that's taking care of her.
This is Marianne Farley's film, Marguerite.
Marguerite,
right?
Yes, yeah. Which is quite touching. And then there's a couple with like bad boys. So there's one with boys stealing candy and killing a baby, and another one where boys are fighting and they end up in quicksand. They're both interesting. La Fauve is the one with the quicksand. I think I prefer that one to Detainment, which is the.
Well, Detainment has been controversial because it's based on a true story about two boys who murdered a toddler. And it's been quite controversial. It felt to me like a TV episode, but they're just despicable kids, and they're treated badly by the police trying to find out what happened to this little boy they just took away from a mall.
Yeah, there have been like protests as to the film's inclusion in this category
because it glorifies.
Yeah, well, they think it seems not glorify, but that it humanizes these kids.
Exploits.
In a way that a lot of folks feel like they should not be humanized. They should just be demonized and treated as monsters. The director went from just the transcripts of the kids' interrogations, and the family of the little boy who was killed was not consulted at all. Mm. And so that is what a lot of the outcry is about. It's like, how can you make this film about our baby and not even talk to us? And so they're mad about Detainment. That is also my least favorite of the five, but not because of that. I like Skin a lot. It just feels the most complete to me in terms of its storytelling, its emotions. It's sadly very relevant. Four out of the five of these, by the way, are kids in trouble movies.
Two of them are Canadian, Marguerite and Fauve. Detainment, as was mentioned, an Irish movie. Madre's from Spain. And Skin is the U.S. film that's being made now, that has been made into a full feature-length movie. Again, the live-action shorts are playing in selected theaters. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle, inviting you to join us. We'll all be there on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel next weekend, Sunday, February
February 17th, 1 in the afternoon. Tickets are available. Last year it sold out. Want to make sure that you're there. Visit kpcc.org/in-person to get your tickets. Sunday, February 17th, exactly 1 week before the Academy Awards are given out in Hollywood at the Dolby Theater. Back with you, of course, every Friday and Saturday. Fridays 11, Saturdays at noon for Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC.